Good afternoon. We're getting well into the second full day of practice. And I find myself wondering, how are your strategies working out? Perhaps you had a strategy to access happiness or have a peaceful heart by getting rid of anger or this chronic pain in your back or all those annoying thoughts that keep coming back over and over again. How's that strategy working out? Perhaps you have the strategy of trying to focus on your anchor and keep out the things that you don't want to see, but it's not cooperating. Your mind is like a wild, trapped animal trying to get out, like the honey badger. We're trying to calm down this wild horse in the mind, but it's not listening. One Tibetan master said that trying to meditate, especially early in a retreat, is like a baby donkey trying to carry a heavy load on ice. And so maybe, you know, that we don't think about donkeys too much maybe here, but we get the idea, right? The image is like, wow, it's kind of slipping and sliding around. Maybe we've decided it's impossible. One note we got recently said that they find themselves in a game of whack-a-mole. So if you guys know whack-a-mole, it's one of those games. It's these moles pop up, and then you try to whack them, and you're whacking one, and then another one pops up somewhere else, and you try to whack that, and you're just, like, trying to whack down all these moles. And they said that the unpleasant thoughts and emotions keep popping up, and they keep whacking down one, and then another one. Is that strategy working? Or maybe we came here hoping that we were going to have some spectacular spiritual experiences and then we would be special and everybody would love us. And that's looking increasingly unlikely. In fact, things have only gotten messier. So how's that strategy working? I recently saw the title of something. It's a title. It says, How to Achieve Mindfulness Without Having to Meditate. 7 Proven Methods. Now, there's a couple problems with that. One is achieve mindfulness. The verb is a little questionable. 7 Proven Methods. I bet some of you wish maybe that you had read that book rather than come here. How many times have you wanted to go home? I mentioned yesterday in the Q&R that most retreats early on, early on meaning the first 15 years, I wanted to go home at least 5 times a day. And it was interesting because at a certain point it just became a thought. It's just like, oh yeah, there's that leaving thought. Which brings us to the question of right effort, which is actually the subject of this talk. Like, right effort wouldn't be getting rid of that thought. Right effort is that I see that thought as just a thought, and then it doesn't have to bother me. And then it arises, okay, that's all right. So a lot of meditation is connecting with our strategies for surviving in this wild, unpredictable world and seeing that they don't work. Thomas Edison, who invented, I believe, the light bulb, right, said, I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that don't work. And that's somewhat like a meditation retreat. So with mindfulness, we get to see and understand deeply which strategies do not bring what we're really hoping for, And that actually is a really, really good start. And a good continuing, too. Because that's very different than not seeing them and continuing to pursue these strategies unconsciously and causing ourselves lots of stress, dukkha, suffering. So seeing what doesn't work is the beginning of opening the heart to life. Ajahn Shanti said, "The role of spiritual practice is basically to exhaust the seeker. If the practice does what it's supposed to do, it exhausts our energy for seeking, and then reality has a chance to present itself." Suzuki Roshi's story from To Shine One Corner of the World by David Chadwick. A student of Suzuki Roshi's saw his teacher of a year and a half in a private meeting. He said that he couldn't continue, that every time he sat meditation, he started to cry. "I can't take it," he said. "I'm leaving. I can't be here anymore." Suzuki Roshi didn't tell him to stay. He merely said, "You try and you try and you fail, and then you go deeper." So perhaps all of our failing strategies are meant to point us to something deeper, something more authentic, something that has a greater chance to answer the yearning of our hearts. So even in this seeing our strategies not work, we're seeing suffering, and we're getting some clues, perhaps, about pointing to the end of suffering. It kind of reminds me sometimes of those in Burma. When we would practice in Burma, the Irrawaddy River would be at it was a dry season, so the Irrawaddy River would be low, and there were there was boat traffic up and down, often big barges full of teak wood going to market. But sometimes these boats would get stuck on sandbars, and we'd be meditating, and you would hear the tugboats trying to get the boat out. Maybe Greg remembers this. It'd be like, brum, brum, and it'd be like they'd be trying, brum, brum, and it would go on for hours, days sometimes, and just trying to get the boat unstuck. Kind of reminds me of meditation sometimes. And then eventually it would come free. So our strategies are closely related to how we meditate, how we make effort, if we want to use that word, in meditation. So I want to look at this quality of effort or energy, virya in Pali. And I want to look at it from a couple sides. Well, I want to look at it from the side of effort and the side of effortlessness, or the side of a kind of more active effort and then a more receptive kind of effort. So I would say that skillful effort involves perseverance, intentionality, and surrender. So it's kind of obvious that if we don't have any intentionality around understanding deeply this heart-body-mind process, which is the purpose of Vipassana meditation, is to understand, to see clearly. The word Vipassana means to see clearly. So to see clearly how life is with this laboratory of ourselves right here, and to have that seeing lead to understanding that frees the heart and mind. And so it's obvious that if we don't have any intentionality to kind of see clearly what's happening, we'll just go on in our usual troublesome way. We'll go on with our usual strategies, And a lot of that includes kind of the suffering, the mental torment we put ourselves through as humans in life, right? The challenging emotions, reactivity, perhaps even the getting lost in busyness and distraction as a way to avoid meeting this human life. And we know we're here because for us that hasn't been a satisfying way to live. It hasn't answered our heart's yearning. I'm assuming that that's why most of us are here, some version of that. So we need some intention. Even sitting down and just having the intention to be mindful is a powerful move and a skillful kind of effort. Intention plants seeds, and then the seeds have a chance to sprout. So we may sit down with the intention to be mindful, and then we know that it's not within our control. So if we think it's within our control, then we've moved off into unskillful effort, controlling, striving. Doesn't work. We see it. We try it. We all try it. That's our first go-to. Is can I control this experience, right? Can I whack down this mole? Can I make things be the way I want them to be? So that's carrying intentionality too far. Just leads to stress. But we do want to stretch some. So many of your friends might have thought you were coming for a spa experience. And sometimes we try to make this place a spa experience. And usually we suggest going to Kripalu if that's what you're looking for. And of course, there's nothing wrong with some comfort, to have some comfort in our seated posture, in our rooms, in our food, whatever, right? But comfort isn't the goal. What the goal is to learn. We want to learn. That's the primary purpose of our meditation practice, is to learn. It's not to create a certain state. It's not to control our experience, but to learn. And maybe even a better or a companion would be to listen, to learn how to listen to this life. We love to boss this life around, right? That's what we mostly do, a lot of that in our lives. And some of it's useful. We do have to get through our day and get things done. But here we have this opportunity to, an hour more receptive mindfulness, to receive life rather than tell it how it should be. To let ourselves be touched by life in all of its wild manifestations, rather than to try to narrow the parameters of what we experience so that we'll be comfortable. And so we stretch some. We want to stretch being here is a pretty big stretch for most people, right? Just to even, you know, give up your cell phones, that's another big stretch to devote a week to this kind of seclusion from your usual distractions is a stretch. And stretching has its own reward. It's satisfying. We gain self-respect and we gain confidence. I hope you've gained a little bit of confidence just by the fact that you're still here. You know, you haven't left yet. So you have something going for you, some kind of strength maybe that you are kind of missing overseeing, because we tend to look at where we're quote-unquote failing, right? So the stretching gives us confidence And it's satisfying because we don't limit ourselves. And we're looking for where we can kind of stretch in our practice with enthusiasm. So what can we perhaps do that helps us just keep growing? So maybe adding in the in-betweenings. If we, when we start, we usually, the formal periods, that feels like enough to deal with. And then the in-between times are, a little bit of a vacation time. But over the days, we can start bringing in more of this intentionality again to be mindful throughout the whole day. Or we start maybe with just mindful while we're brushing our teeth, or mindful while we're eating, or mindful as we come into the hall and sit down. Just adding little micro mindfulness periods. It's really great because you get all this extra meditation for free. You're already here. If you're mindful during the three eating times, that's like two meditation periods. That's like an hour and a half, right? So two meditation periods. So it's great. That's a way we can stretch. And we see how we can do it with enthusiasm. The first time my teacher suggested that we might do that, I just looked at him and I said, "You've got to be kidding." I was like, "I'm not doing that," because it was too intense for me. But I did. I started adding in little periods, and then eventually it became more natural to just think of the day as, we say, seamless. It's the intention to be mindful is here all day, even if there, of course, are varying levels of concentration. Sometimes a noting is a way of stretching a little bit for some people, if it works for you, because it kind of keeps us on task, that little note, in, out, thinking, stinging, stabbing, aversion. You can play with that. Trying to think of what I can jettison because I'm not going to get through all this. We can also translate effort, virya, as diligence. One teacher, Dhiravamsa, says it's like hens sitting on their eggs. Steady, patient, nothing apparently is happening, but we trust. Or perhaps wholeheartedness. That might have a better flavor than the word effort. Even right away, the word effort, we're like, wholeheartedness, giving our hearts to our practice. Somebody years ago wrote a letter to this center while I was on staff, and they addressed it to the Instant Meditation Society. And I found myself hoping they did not come on retreat because they would recognize that it's slow, right? It's a slow process. Apparently in the 1850s in Paris, there was a trend of taking your tortoise for a walk on the boulevard. And there's something about that image that reminds me of meditation. Sometimes it's like we're taking our tortoise for a walk, right? And yet, with perseverance, really just sticking at it, sometimes that's just what right effort is just to keep going. And we want to do it in a sustainable way. So my husband and I like to go hiking, and we have two different ways of hiking. So he likes to, go really hard, fast and go, and then stop and rest. And I like to go at a slower, kind of more plodding speed, but I don't like to rest. I just like to keep plodding along. And, for hiking, those probably both work, but for meditation, my way is better. We want to just kind of plod along, steady, diligent, and in that way kind of keeping our enthusiasm. So we make some effort, we have some intentionality, we have this perseverance. And then sometimes this morphs into the area of trying too much, making too much effort or the wrong kind of effort. So we've talked about this a lot because it's such a common experience. All this territory of trying too hard, using our will too forcefully, striving, expectation, trying to make something happen. And it seems like we all need to do this. I haven't yet come across a meditation practitioner who hasn't started here. And then we have to see that this strategy doesn't work. What we start to see as we try so hard is that we get more entangled. And we actually become more disconnected. It's like the harder we try to be here, the more disconnected we become. So there's a way that we have to really understand this energy, this willpower. A lot of it's willpower. We are, the dominant culture in the United States is one of willpower. And many of us are good at that. I was in my first early practice. I really thought that willpower was the way to do it, that this was how I was going to get somewhere, was by the strength of my will to make things be the way I thought they should be. I think that practice on some level is meant to break our will. It's meant to leave us with just enough will to be able to act with kindness and wisdom. We have to learn to trust something besides for willpower. Maybe our homing instinct, maybe grace, maybe the Dhamma, maybe benevolence. Something maybe we're not so used to. We like to use our will to override what our systems need. And when I talked about listening, this is one place where it's important. We start to listen to what is the truth of our experience rather than overriding it and trying to make it be something that it isn't. I had so much willpower until my health gave out. That's what the result was in my early 30s. Often happens around that age. And then I had to learn to trust something else because willpower wasn't going to do it anymore. I didn't have the energy for that. That's when I went deeper. One of my favorite effort stories involves a man named Dave Smith, who's now a Dharma teacher, but at the time I knew him as a young man and a volunteer for the teen retreat that I taught here for 18 years. And he was saying to me one day, he was like, you know how you go out of the meditation hall and you kind of hope there's a note for you on the board? Especially in the longer retreats, it's like, does anybody know I'm alive? and I said, yeah, I know what you're talking about. He goes, well, I used to leave notes for myself. And I said, well, what did the notes say? And he said, one note said, you're trying hard enough. It was such a, right, such a beautiful gift to himself. So much wisdom. You're trying hard enough. So whenever you hear the word in your mind, should or shouldn't, watch out. Because that dukkha is surely to follow. Like my practice should be doing this or it shouldn't be doing this. This should be happening or this shouldn't be happening. That's all kind of a clue that we're headed towards a territory of unhelpful effort. Sometimes we just feel this pervasive assumption that what is happening shouldn't be happening. It can be very pervasive, right? There's a slight problem with that, and that's that it is happening. And the subtext is, I should be able to control this. I can't, therefore I'm failing. A hint, you can't control it. You're not failing. You're human. So we find that this practice takes us more deeply into our humanity. We had kind of hoped that we were going to transcend, right? That we were going to get out of here. At least I started that way. I read somewhere that the most common human thought is, get me out of here. One that most of you probably had at some point, followed by ring the damn bell. But really, we're just coming down to earth and being here as full human beings, experiencing the fullness of heart, body, and mind, which includes pleasure and pain, joy and sorrow. So what if instead of hoping to be special, we just hope to be ordinary? It's such a relief. Being special is so much work. One time I thought, you know, being an influencer must be just a horrible job. Imagine having to be special day after day after day. But we kind of do that to ourselves, don't we? So meditation practice is a chance to just be ordinary. Pablo Dors, I believe he might be a Christian priest again, Catholic priest. We're on the Catholic priest thing. Said that there's some great Catholic priests. I know there's some problems too, but there are some actually great Catholic priests. Pablo Dors said that his Zen teacher makes it clear that I'm not yet who I truly am, but rather someone still too cunning and unnecessarily complex. So we're just trying to become who we are. We're aiming for a kind of emotional honesty and authenticity, which gets real about what the truth of this moment is. But we're pretty cunning and complex, and we're trying to get simpler. I would say that metta is such a support in skillful effort because metta allows us to learn to soften into what's happening rather than will ourselves towards some ideal. So this is actually also what really helped shift me out of depending only on willpower. Maybe we can depend on love. instead of willpower. I was so surprised to see that maybe we're supposed to do this journey with love. And that metta creates the heart that's gentle and wide enough and relaxed enough to settle down to earth here in our full humanity. I'm not sure we can do it without a fair amount of metta and compassion. Because there's a lot we go through, right? And metta makes it doable. Kindness makes it doable. We're just trying to love our way through the struggles of being human and slowly melting what Anam Thubten calls the ice mountains in our hearts. We're melting the ice mountains. And then being able to be touched by this world and also an active participant in this world. So all of our perseverance and our diligence and our intentionality, you could say they're the support for mindfulness. We create the causes and conditions that support mindfulness. We don't will ourselves to change, but yet we can create the causes and conditions that allow mindfulness to arise, and then mindfulness or mindful awareness does the work. So the causes, conditions, come on a retreat. That's a cause and condition. Put away our cell phones. All the renunciation and simplicity that you've done is a major cause and condition for mindfulness to arise, for mindful awareness to arise. And when we do the metta, we're trying to create whatever conditions might help metta arise. So we're looking, for example, for what touches the heart or reminds the heart or lets the heart have a moment or two of warmth and kindness. And we try different things. We can't will metta. Of course, we try that too, right? Like, okay, come on, heart, it's time. Time to open. And the heart's like, wait a moment. I have my own timetable here. And so that doesn't work, but we try that, right? Failing strategy, tell the heart what to do. With metta, we actually listen to the heart and let it tell us what it needs. We develop a respectful relationship. And so when we do metta, we're learning about our heart and what it needs. And so you can't mess it up. If what happens when we're doing metta is the heart feels hard, impenetrable, an ice mountain, okay, can we just touch that with softness and say, hello, I see you. Yes. The heart always has a good reason if it's like that. It's not an accident. And then the heart, as we listen, it starts to trust us a bit more, and then it might be willing to try something different. And then we see, like, what might spark some kind of kindness. It might, again, it might be our pet or a child or a flower. So we don't have to try. We create the causes and conditions that support. That's a big part of skillful effort. And so there's a way that our effort, perseverance, diligence, all that, is supported by or moves in and combines with something that we might call surrender. And that's the willingness to meet what's here. So that might be the answer to the whack-a-mole, is willingness to meet what's here. And yet I say that, it sounds so easy, right? But we have resistance. This is normal. We may be interested right now in meeting what's here, and you know, an hour later we might not. That's okay. That's just our heart trying to work it out. We start to learn to let things be. Like thoughts, for example, we can definitely get into a whole thing of trying to control thoughts and make them not arise, get rid of them, especially ones we don't like. But over time we learn it's just a thought. And we let it be. We don't have to get involved in it. My teacher used to really stress having non-preference for thinking or not thinking. That's a great practice, to have non-preference about whether we're thinking or not thinking. That's letting it be. I went through a period once on a retreat where I was judging all the other meditators, something some of you may have done. And, you know, pretty relentlessly, anytime I was out and around, you know, look at how he walks, doesn't he know he should walk quieter, look at how much food they're taking, you don't need that much food on a retreat, and look at what they're wearing, and it was pretty, and I felt horrible about myself. I hated these thoughts, wanted them to stop, and I went into my teacher, and Joseph Goldstein, he's great at the one-liners. So I went into him, to my teacher, and I was complaining about what a bad person I was. And he just looked at me and he said, "It's just a thought." And like, I got it in that moment. It was like, oh, right? If I believe those thoughts and get involved with them, we could have a problem. Wars start that way. but if it's just a thought, what's the problem? And the thoughts quit bothering me. And then they incidentally also started happening less because I wasn't getting all involved in them and getting, you know, in a fight with them. It's just the thought. That's a kind of surrender and letting it be. Of course, if we go way down the train track, you know, we get off and come back. Same with emotions. We learn how to let them be, to give them space, but without getting swept away. We'll talk more about that tomorrow morning. A kind of surrender to whatever's arising. We can find, it reminds me of one time when I was talking with a student, and he's like, "I tried this, I have anger, lots of anger, I tried this, I tried that, not helping, not working." And I said, "Maybe the anger just wants some space to be." And he came back later and he said, "Yeah, that was exactly it. It's like, make some room in our rib cage. Just let the anger just be there with kind, holding attention." That's a surrender. So we quit fighting with our experience, our fighting with what's arising more and more, right? We still, as long as we're alive, we're probably, you know, still, except maybe very rare occasions, we're still seeing what is it that needs to be met and included. What are we exiling that we can bring home? That's another way I talk about it. We're bringing the pieces of ourself home, all those pieces that we said, no, not you, can't do you. Mm-mm. We're like, oh yeah, this is part of my humanity. This is part of being a human being. And it's okay. It's alive, actually. We become more alive is what really happens, because when we're in the enclosure, the enclosure of only of what's limiting what's okay and what's not, what we can connect with and what we can't, we're like poor old Stoffel, you know, stuck in his enclosure. And it's smaller. Right, so we're actually increasing the size of our mind and heart as we pick up all these pieces that we've exiled, the loneliness, the anger, the yearning, and bring them home. Oops. So why put 2 minutes to 5 o'clock? How did that happen? So we slip into effortlessness. We need both. We need effort and we need effortlessness. That's a paradox, right? But effortlessness is this more receptive quality that receives what life offers. One Zen teacher says, say yes to all offers. So we say yes to all offers in the moment. And of course, we work skillfully with the moment. The surrender is not a, it's not passive. It's, I think Greg said something about, I can't remember the exact wording, but something about an engaged presence, right? We respond appropriately after we accept all offers. And we learn to trust awareness and let it do the work. I think I will end with a poem by one of the early nuns, which describes somewhat this this progression. So this is a poem of Patachara. There's a book called the Early Buddhist Women, and it's a translation of the Terigata, which are the songs of the elder nuns, so the enlightenment poems of the first nuns during the time of the Buddha. And one of them is Patachara. So Patachara went through a really rough patch. In a 24-hour period, her husband died from a snake bite. An eagle took off with one of her babies, and the other one drowned in the river. And then her family, that home, collapsed, and her extended family all died. So all this happened in 24 hours, and she lost her mind. She was very, of course, very upset. And she wandered for a while, and finally she found the Buddha and regained her mind and became a nun. And she struggled in her practice, just like we do. She says, "But I've done everything right and followed the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud. Why haven't I found peace?" So you get the sense, right? She's trying some strategies that are not working, but she's really sincere. You can imagine what she's had to deal with. And then one day it says, "Bathing my feet, I watched the bath water spill down the slope." Continuity. "I watched the bath water spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp and went into my cell, checked the bed and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed." So you get the sense of this diligence over years and years of practice, right? Frustration, just like you all are feeling. And then in this moment of deep relaxation, she was going to sleep, right? So she was like, ah. You can imagine, like when you go in your room, right? You go, ah. So she had this moment of putting it all down, surrender, letting go, and her mind was free. Effort and effortlessness together. Let's sit for a minute. So the trick with the Dharma talk is if there's anything that resonated that seemed like it would support your practice, you can bookmark that. And then let the rest of the words float away. You don't have to remember them all. One or two good tidbits is enough.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.